So good morning, everyone. How are we doing?
Still here.
It's only the second day, but it already feels like we've been here a week or so. It always strikes me as a minor miracle that we take a day or two to get set up and for everybody to learn their jobs and how to do things and learn how to eat that way. And before long, you know, like the second day, we are functioning with all the components of Zen monastic practice. You're all quietly eating Oryoki style. Like, it's very settled, even though many of you are new to it. I only heard one pair of chopsticks drop, so that's really... And ringing the bells, and hitting the han, and clapping the clappers, and bravely sitting so quietly. I always find it really moving, you know, that in 2 days we can come from busy urban life and practice this way. It's a miracle. We're still a relatively small group. So it's a modest-sized monastery. But have you ever wondered what it would be like to do this practice all on your own? In a little cabin somewhere. That's how Michael and I first came to this place, is we each just took a week and stayed in the cabin that we are in now, up the hill, and did a solo retreat. And in some traditions, that's a really crucial part of practice, but it's not emphasized in Zen, so we really wanted to try it. And it was wonderful, but we'd already done a lot of sesshin, so we kind of just naturally kept to those rhythms, even though I put my watch in the closet for the whole week. And to see what it would be like to kind of follow my natural sitting, you know, how my body wanted. So I tended to sit more than 30 minutes earlier in the day, and a little shorter later in the day, and I fell into a rhythm that was very, very close to sesshin, but a little different. And my Dharma talks were long walks. So we're talking about the old mountain hermits of ancient China and the Taoist roots of Zen these few days. And I'd like to start with a poem written in the 4th century of the Common Era by Dao Qian. Dao Qian was, we don't know his given name, the name he was born with. This is the name he took, and it just means hermit of the Tao. Home again among fields and gardens. Nothing like all the others, even as a child, rooted in such love for hills and mountains. I stumbled into the net of dust, that one departure a blunder lasting 13 years. But a tethered bird longs for its old forest, and a pond fish its deep waters. So now, my southern outlands cleared, I nurture simplicity among these fields and gardens, home again. I've got nearly 2 acres here, and 4 or 5 rooms in this thatch hut, elms and willows shading the eaves and back, and in front, peach and plum spread wide. Villages lost across mist and haze distances, kitchen smoke drifting, wide open country. Dogs bark deep among back roads out here, and roosters crow from mulberry treetops. No confusion within these gates, no dust. My empty home harbors idleness to spare. Back again, after so long trapped, caged in that trap, I've returned to nature. Have you ever wanted to go back to nature? To live a simple life in the country, growing your own food? Or perhaps spend time in a remote cabin in the mountains, far from the blaring noise and lights of the city? I have. And I have. It's always been a deep part of me, this yearning to live close to the turning of the seasons, the cycles of the moon, stillness and motion, life and death, silence and sounds. So vividly present when we are awake in the wild. In the wild and also in the in-between that he describes the fields and gardens, close to the wild, but a little bit domesticated. For me, that's where I grew up. Close to the wild, a little bit domesticated. But with nature, the great earth, as my first teacher. My mom tells the story of me as a toddler in a little red sweater disappearing over the hill into the woods. And she saw me just in time. Even when I've lived in cities, I've chosen to live at the edge, where I can easily walk out into the wild. So the language and the experience of these old Zen poets of China and Japan has resonated with me since I first encountered them, which was probably when I first read the American poet Gary Snyder's translations of Hanshan, or Cold Mountain, decades ago. I find it comforting somehow to realize that the old hermit poets struggled with the same ambivalence that I felt as a young woman and sometimes still now as an oldish woman about life in the world of red dust, as the Chinese called the world of human affairs. We named this Sesshin, Mountains and Waters Sesshin, after a text by Dogen Zenji. Dogen, for those of you who don't know him, was the Japanese founder of our line of Zen, Soto Zen, brought that practice from China to Japan in the 13th century. And he wrote a text called Mountains and Waters Sutra, Sansui Kyo, which we focused on a lot in the past couple of years. So we're not going to focus on it this year, but we will mention it. And but Dogen did not originate that phrase, mountains and waters. It comes from a tradition of poetry and painting, which arose in 5th century China, at a time when political culture had become corrupt. So what's new? And full of deadly infighting. That was a long time ago. At the same time, Taoist thought was undergoing a resurgence and intermingling with the new influx of Zen philosophy and, of Buddhist philosophy and teaching from India, which would lead to what came to be called Chan, or Zen in Japanese, which simply means meditation. It simply means a school of Buddhism that emphasized meditation as opposed to studying texts or following the precepts. Not that those aren't part of our practice as well, but that's all that Zen means, is it came to be called that. For that reason, the emphasis on meditation and on direct experience, unmediated, direct experience of the Tao, which we could also call Buddha nature, couldn't we? At that same time in China, northern China had been occupied by tribes which were considered barbarians, in how it always is. And many intellectuals had fled to the southeast, which was an area of beautiful wild mountains, those ones we associate with classical Chinese painting. And so withdrawing to live in seclusion in the mountains became an actually respected alternative to serving in a corrupt government bureaucracy. Living a simple life of meditation, reading Taoist and Buddhist texts, cultivating a garden. I was so happy to realize that they, you know, they had gardens. They had little orchards, many of them. And foraging in the forest for food and writing poetry. Living in the mountain wilderness was not always idyllic. There are bugs. The mountain hermit poets wrote of being cold, wet, hungry, and lonely. But they wrote about those experiences matter-of-factly as they wrote about the changing weather and the seasons. The wilderness of mountains and waters is the wilderness of the heart, mind, and body. You know, so we got to be prepared that we step into the wilderness, we step into the wilderness of our own body, mind. Our blood is wild. Our respiratory system is wild. Our nervous system is definitely wild. Most of our brain is still wild. You know, the microorganisms in our gut are wild. Although maybe they're kind of semi-domesticated. I don't know if we domesticated them or they domesticated us. So we've got to be prepared for some wildness, you know, when we get away from all the distractions that make us think we have control over our lives. Mountains and waters. San Shui in Chinese, San Sui in Japanese. Mountain is san or shan, and shui is water. It's sometimes translated as mountains and rivers. You'll see both. But I kind of prefer waters because because that's what the actual character is. It's not the character for rivers. And because waters includes the rushing mountains, torrents, the waterfalls, the pool, the quiet pools, the rainstorms, the mists. Have you seen the little pools, the little pool drops on the huckleberry bush, huckleberry leaves? And they take a different shape on the willow leaves. Different leaves, the drops take different patterns and shapes. So all the waters, including the waters in us. San Shui is also often translated as landscape. But that doesn't really convey the spiritual aspect of this practice. And in English, landscape is seen as something we view from a distance. You know, it's scenery. Snap a picture. Whereas the relationship with mountains and waters in these poems is direct. Direct experience without separation of subject and object. That merging with the Tao that Michael talked about yesterday. In those San Shui paintings, Chinese paintings, they're often scrolls. And as you unscroll them, you see that the people, there are people in them, but they're really small. Right? There's a little farmer in the field. There's a little hermit up on his mountain. And some children playing as the scroll unfolds. The humans don't dominate the landscape. They participate in it. Uh, David Hinton is a wonderful translator who specializes in translating these poets, and this is his book called Mountain Home, The Wilderness Poetry of Ancient China. He says, fundamentally different, these poems are fundamentally different from writing that employs the natural world, in quotes, as the stage or materials for human concerns. Instead, this poetry articulates a profound and spiritual sense of belonging to a wilderness of truly awesome dimensions. This is not a wilderness in the superficial sense of nature or landscape, terms the Western cultural lens has generally applied to the most fundamental aspect of Chinese poetry. Nature calls up a false dichotomy between humans and nature. But the Chinese wilderness is nothing less than a dynamic cosmology in which humans participate in the most fundamental way. I mean, this is something that I think came as natural knowledge to in indigenous cultures pretty much throughout the world. And we see this in the teachings of those cultures. And maybe this is a time to mention and acknowledge that the Squamish people lived, you know, for thousands of years in this very environment, you know, fishing from these rivers, foraging from this land, and knew it in ways much more intimate than most of us have can even imagine. And yet, as Hinton continues, the poetry of this wilderness cosmology feels utterly contemporary, and in an age of global ecological disruption and mass extinction, this engagement with wilderness makes it more urgently and universally important by the day. I agree. As you'll see, we're not talking about mountains and waters practice as a way to just to escape, to get away from what we don't like in the dusty world, but a way to live fully in the world so that we can be at home wherever we are. Dao Chen, whose poem I began with, is considered the father of San Shui poetry. He wrote, "Vast and majestic, mountains embrace your shadow. Broad and deep, rivers harbor your voice." He came from an educated aristocratic family, and initially he followed the expected path and took his place in the government bureaucracy. But he disliked the restrictions and deceptions of that life and eventually left to take up residence on a farm in his ancestral village, just northwest of a mountain called Thatch Hut Mountain, which was known as a place for Taoist hermits. So this had already been going on, you know, for hundreds of years, but his significance was that he began to write poetry in a different style than had been used, using his natural voice and describing his relationship with the environment, the wind and the rain, the turning seasons, smells and tastes. But English translation is often inadequate for some of the Taoist concepts that come up in this poetry. For example, just going back to the last four lines of the poem, he says, "No confusion within these gates, no dust, my empty home harbors idleness to spare." So Hinton translates this Taoist term, xian, as idleness. But it kind of skews the meaning, I think. In English, idleness is associated with what?
Laziness,
right? That's not good. That's not productive. It's unvirtuous. Idle hands are the devil's workshop. Have you ever heard that? Right? It's one wording of a proverb from the Bible. So I Googled it, and I found a commentary on a Christian website that says, we live in a sinful world, and a person who doesn't have something particular to do will invariably be tempted to do something sinful. If we have nothing to do, the devil is all too eager to find things to occupy our time.
Amen.
So we don't feel good if we're just sitting around doing nothing. You know, this is very strongly ingrained. Let's contrast this with Hinton's discussion. He has a little glossary of Taoist terms in the back. And his discussion of Xian. He says it connotes a profound serenity and quietness. And then he talks about the pictographic elements of the character, which I wish I could show you, but I didn't get that prepared for this talk. But what the character shows, it represents moonlight shining through an empty gate. The unobstructed light of awareness. No devil in sight. And the last two lines of the poem are, back again after so long caged in that trap, I've returned to nature. So I'm going to confess now that I altered Hinton's translation and said nature, which actually sounds kind of like a cliche, back to nature. You know, skinny dipping hippies. But what Hinton says is, I've returned to occurrence coming of itself. And to me, that sounds kind of clunky and unpoetic and obscure. What to do? The Chinese word, tsujen, or shizen in Japanese, is typically translated as nature. But as we've already said, so often in Western thought, we see nature as being separate from the world of human beings, right? You know, the word man-made. Human beings and our constructions. Nature, like the TV program, is kind of a spectacle we view and enjoy from a safe distance, without the bugs. Have you noticed, has anybody watched nature sometimes, once in a while, or other nature shows? Have you noticed how in recent years they have inserted more and more kind of zooming fast forwards with fake sound effects?
Yes.
So that nature looks and feels more and more like a computer game? This is really alarming and deeply disheartening to me. How would children habituated to expect fast action with sound effects have the patience to watch a pond quietly until they see a beaver's blunt nose plowing awake through the water? Boring. Till the beaver slaps his tail. But the Chinese characters for this word reveal a much deeper meaning. The first, zi or shi, means self. Not the ego self, there's another word for that, but the self that realizes it exists only in a matrix of interconnection with all other phenomena. And the second character, zhen or zen, means literally ablaze. Flaming up, and then so figuratively manifesting just this, thus, in this moment, manifesting. So together they become self-manifesting thus, just this. Or spontaneous, natural. Hence that awkward translation, occurrence coming of itself. But Shizen, the Japanese comes to me kind of automatically, describes the 10,000 things, each arising spontaneously from what the Tao calls the darkness, the generative nothingness, the formless, the undifferentiated, from which all phenomena come into being and return to non-being, only to return to being again in another form. So that's the Tao, and the De, actually, maybe I knew it before, but I forgot, knew that the De is the manifestation, the workings of the Tao in the world. So the Tao and the De are, we would say in Zen, the absolute and the relative, you know, which are simultaneous realities, always. And of course, you know, we know the yin-yang symbol, which shows that, with the dot of white in the black and the dot of black in the white. So, rather than idleness, that stillness of Xian is a meditative ease with Tsujian, with the natural. The essence of our practice is right here in the details of daily life, of everyday life. As Nan Chuan said in the famous koan Michael gave you yesterday, everyday mind is the way. With everyday mind as the way, we might find our home in the mountains, the village, or even in city streets. As another one from Dao Jian says, I live here in a village house without all that racket horses and carts stir up. And you wonder how that could ever be. Wherever the mind dwells apart is itself a distant place. Picking chrysanthemums at my east fence, I see South Mountain far off. Air lovely at dusk, birds in flight returning home. All this means something, something absolute. Whenever I start to explain it, I forget words altogether. So again, it echoes that the very first opening lines of the Tao Te Ching. The Tao that can be spoken is not the Tao. Yeah. 800 years later, Dogen, who I just mentioned, the founder of our school of Zen in Japan, used an expression, Jijuyu Zammai, which is literally, you could translate it as self-receiving and employing samadhi. Jijuyu is three characters. Ji is that same character for self that we just talked about. Ju is to receive, as in Jukai, receiving the precepts. That's a word some of you know. Jiju, yu is to use, to utilize. And Zammai is samadhi. Samadhi, the state of luminous, unobstructed awareness. So what is samadhi in which the self is receiving and utilizing? Receiving and utilizing what? Dogen wrote a text very early in his teaching life called Bendoa, or Endeavor of the Way. And he explains Jijuyu Zammai. He says, all Buddhas who individually transmit inconceivable dharma actualizing unsurpassed complete enlightenment, have a wondrous art, supreme and unconditioned. He's a little hyperbolic here. The mark of this, unsurpassed complete enlightenment is Jijiyu Zanmai. Self-fulfilling is another way it's translated, receptive samadhi. Sitting upright, practicing Zen, is the authentic gate to free yourself in the unconfined realm of this samadhi. Although this inconceivable dharma is abundant in each person, it is not actualized without practice, and it is not experienced without realization. When you release it, it fills your hand. How could it be limited to one or many? When you speak it, meaning when it leaves your mouth, when you speak it, it fills your mouth. It is not bounded by length or width. The concentrated endeavor of the way I am speaking of allows all things to come forth in enlightenment and practice. All inclusiveness without attachment. So we could, there's a lot packed in there. We could reread this passage substituting Tao for it, for inconceivable Dharma. And it would sound like it came straight out of the Tao Te Ching. It would sound like this. When you release it, the Tao, it fills your hand. How could it be limited to one or many? When you speak it, it fills your mouth. It is not bounded by length or width. So he's describing the practice of the old mountain hermits. Practice, enlightenment, and actualization in a kind of dynamic synergy. Don't ever think this practice is passive. The self receiving and utilizing the 10,000 things and being received and utilized by them. The ravens, the waterfalls, the ancient red cedars, the banana slugs, the color of pale yellow Chinese jade, the street person, your boss, the building that goes up, the new condo that goes up and shuts out the light from your apartment. All the 10,000 things. All inclusiveness without attachment. So let this practice, let this be your practice for these few days that we're here in this forest, overlooking Daisy Lake and these great boulders that have broken, like calving. They're like, you know, they use the word calving for glaciers, like giving birth. It feels like the mountain has given birth to these boulders, and these boulders are then full of life. Look at the life on these boulders. Okay, I can't resist giving you one more hermit, even though it'll run over time. Because Han Shan was the first for me. Like Dao Qian, he spent his early years in the dusty world. Though we know nothing about those years, who he was then. Han Shan is just the name of the mountain where he made his hermitage, Cold Mountain. But there are passing references. There are a number of fine translations, but I'm just going to be loyal to Gary Snyder. And he only translated 24 of the 300. In my first 30 years of life, I roamed hundreds and thousands of miles, walked by rivers through deep green grass, entered cities of boiling red dust, tried drugs but couldn't make immortal, read books and wrote poems on history. Today I am back at Cold Mountain. I'll sleep by the creek and purify my ears. So, of course, this is Gary Snyder's translation in the... Did he do it? 50s and 60s, yeah. Yeah. So, when he says tried drugs couldn't make him mortal, what he means is Taoist potions. You know, they were into immortality and kind of alchemical potions. But Han Shan too retreated into the mountains. And at the foot of his mountain was a Chan monastery he often visited and received handouts of food from the kitchen where his friend and sidekick Sherda worked. You often see them in paintings, these just wacky looking guys, Han Shan and Sherda. Sherda was often called in English pickup, because he was found by Han Shan's other friend, Big Stick is how he's translated. And he was kind of a big kind of... I imagine him as... Who's that big guy in Harry Potter? The big, the giant guy?
Hagrid.
That's how I imagine Big Stick, is Hagrid. So Big Stick was out and saw this abandoned child crying by the roadside and brought him back to the monastery to be cared for. And so that was how he got the name Pickup. He was picked up from the roadside and worked in the kitchen ever after and became Han Shan's dear friend. So after many years on the mountain, Han Shan wrote... I settled at Cold Mountain Already it seems like years and years. Freely drifting, I prowl the woods and streams and linger watching things themselves. Men don't get this far into the mountains. White clouds gather and billow. Thin grass does for a mattress. The blue sky makes a good quilt. Happy with a stone under head, let heaven and earth go about their changes. I have lived at Cold Mountain these 30 long years. Yesterday I called on friends and family. More than half had gone to the Yellow Springs. That's the afterlife. Slowly consumed like a fire down a candle. Forever flowing like a passing river. Now, morning, I face my lone shadow. Suddenly my eyes are bleared with tears. There's a naked bug at Cold Mountain with a white body and a black head. He means himself. His hand holds two book scrolls, one the way and one its power. So that's the Tao and the De. He's talking about his Taoist scrolls. His shack's got no pots or oven. He goes for a walk with his shirt and pants askew. But he always carries the sword of wisdom. He means to cut down senseless craving. Although Han Shan and Sherda were ragged and often thought crazy or simple-minded, they came to be regarded as incarnations of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. That's, he says, carrying the sword of wisdom. That's how Manjushri is depicted. And Samantabhadra, the Bodhisattva of shining practice and skillful means. Gary Snyder, in his note, says, you can still sometimes run into them today in the Skid Rows, orchards, hobo jungles, and logging camps of America. And because this hermit tradition, as it has been recorded, seems more male than it likely actually was, I can't help but add that you might find Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. That's her up there. In unlikely places to this day as well. In earlier times, she might have been an old woman who lived alone and gathered herbs from the wild, knowing their healing properties, who people came to when they were ill or in trouble. In Zen stories, she's often an anonymous old woman selling tea by the roadside. Watch out. She's a trickster with a compassionate heart. Around the time that Gary Snyder was reading and translating Han Shan's poetry, he and his poet friends Jack Kerouac and Philip Whalen enacted a 20th century version of mountain hermit practice by taking jobs as fire lookouts in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State. Here's Gary Snyder's poem from that time. It's called Mid-August at Sourdough Mountain Lookout. Down valley, a smoke haze. 3 days heat after 5 days rain. Pitch glows on the fir cones. Across rocks and meadows, swarms of new flies. I cannot remember things I once read. A few friends, but they are in cities. Drinking cold snow water from a tin cup. Looking down for miles through high, still air. And another one from a different season at the same lookout by Philip Whalen, who later became a Zen priest and teacher and abbot in our own lineage in San Francisco. Then I'm alone in a glass house on a ridge. You know, the fire lookout? Yeah. Encircled by chiming mountains. With one sun roaring through the house all day and others crashing through the glass all night. Conscious even while sleeping. In fact, I'm going to recommend that practice for you tonight. When you go to bed, keep meditating. See if you can stay awake, aware as you shift from wakefulness to sleep. Gary Snyder went on to work for over 40 years on a book-length poetry manuscript he called Mountains and Rivers Without End. And he named it after an ancient Chinese scroll with that same title. There were many scrolls titled that because of that tradition. But it was a particular one that he saw when he was young. And he resolved that he would create a poetic Mountains and Rivers Without End, in which he would express his own experience of what he called a chaotic universe where everything is in place. And threaded through that long sequence, sort of unfurling like a scroll, he repeats these words, walking on, walking, underfoot earth turns, streams and mountains never stay the same. That'll keep coming back in this book. When Dogen wrote the Mountains and Waters Sutra, it was an unusual title. You don't call things sutras unless a sutra typically refers to the earliest Buddhist texts, right? The Pali Canon. Those are sutras. Or the early Mahayana texts, which were also called sutras to kind of enhance their status as part of the canon. But to write something and call it a sutra, that many hundreds and hundreds of years later, was quite unusual. But Dogen was not so arrogant as to think, I'm writing a sutra about mountains and waters. What he meant was that the mountains and waters themselves are giving us their teachings, are chanting a sutra if we hear and see with our whole being. So what do the mountains and waters have to teach us? When we let obstruction drop away, when we receive and utilize the 10,000 things as they come to meet us in the stillness of a quiet heart and mind, or sometimes when we bump smack into them when we're not in a still, quiet mind, then so that's actually some of the real wake-ups happen, right? When we get surprised. These days, it's not so easy to go into the mountains and find a hut or a cave to live in. Turns out there'll be a cell phone tower up the next ridge. The hazards are both similar and different to those the old hermits encountered. Slippery, icy rock staircases, thieves, politicians eager to befriend us, loneliness for our friends and family. Regrets. But like the sages of old, we can enter the mountains, enter the wild even for a short time, and return to the dusty world changed, a little more open to being surprised and moved by the world of human life, just as it is, a little more accepting and grateful of our own life, just as it is. Able to lift our eyes from the rush hour traffic on the highway going through Burnaby and see the river of crows flowing overhead on their way to their evening roost. How many people have seen those crows? Yeah. They've been doing that for a very long time.
There are a lot of them.
Yeah. Maybe we'll be a little more able to follow the great way. Maybe our saving all beings doesn't look so much like strenuous helping, and yet it frees beings from fear and constriction, like Hanshan did by his own freedom. So, to close with some lines from the Tao Te Ching, the best are like water, bringing help to all without competing, choosing what others avoid. Thus they approach the Tao, dwelling with earth, thinking with depth, helping with kindness, speaking with honesty, governing with peace, working with skill, and moving with time. And because they don't compete, they aren't maligned. So, thank you, fellow hermits. May I...